Don't pay retail for your diamond engagement ring or gift. Come to cleanorigin.com. Founded by a leading family in the diamond industry for more than a century, we're experts in lab-grown diamonds because that's all we do. Clean Origin, the only diamond jewelers who give you a 100-day, no-questions-asked return on your purchase. Head to cleanorigin.com or one of our retail stores and mention code RADIO10 for an additional 10% off your purchase. That's cleanorigin.com, code RADIO10.
When we talk about weather disasters, our minds often go towards tornadoes, hurricanes, and severe weather. But flooding is the most common and most expensive natural disaster in the United States. First Street Foundation, a science and technology nonprofit, has released a new study evaluating the flood risk to our nation's critical infrastructure. The study evaluates the risk for every neighborhood, zip code, city, and county in the country. Joining us today is Dr. Jeremy Porter, who leads the research and development efforts at First Street Foundation, to break down the findings and the impacts of this expansive research study. Jeremy, thank you for joining us on the Weather Geeks podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk about our recent report.
Well, I'm really excited about it because as someone that's sort of interested in hydrometeorological extremes in my own research, I look forward to sort of hearing about what you are discussing. But before I do that, let me give you some of Jeremy's background. He has a PhD in sociology and demography with a PhD minor in applied statistics from Mississippi State University. He has a Master of Arts in Urban Geography and a Bachelor of Arts in Sociology from the University of Louisville. I don't know if this is the appropriate question to ask, given your background, but I often ask my guests right out of the gate, how did you become a weather geek? Are you a weather geek, or are you just studying out of curiosity?
That's funny because, you know, I listened to the podcast and it is, that, you know, I knew the question was coming because I've heard you ask. And my background is clearly more in the social sciences, but really I've always been more of a implications, quantitative methods, statistics based person. So I'm probably more in the realm of data science than I am substantively a weather person. But you know, in the past, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, I've been working really heavily with the First Street Foundation and really focused on taking the research that we're doing with folks that are climate scientists and folks that are more in the realm of your own research, and taking that work and sort of expanding on it. So our goal is to build out the science with partners that are experts in the area, but then to really take it one step further and add on the implications component. So we want to know, what are the social implications? What are the economic implications of what we're seeing? And not only what are they going to be, because we know there's a changing environment, but are they already happening? And can we measure that? And can we tell people in a way that's easy to communicate that, you know, climate change isn't something that's going to happen in 2100. It's something that's been happening for X number of years. And this is how we're going to show you that it's been happening directly to you.
Yeah, that's a great point and something that I've tried to articulate as well. Dr. Porter is a professor and director of the quantitative methods in the social sciences program at the City University of New York. Research associate, at the Institute for Demographic Research, and appointed to the faculty as a lecturer at Columbia University's Environmental Health Sciences program. So clearly you are someone that reminds me of people that I often work with. I'm actually in a geography department at the University of Georgia and work with folks with backgrounds like yours all of the time. So it's really fascinating. Tell us a little bit about the study that we have you on today and what's driving it.
Yeah. So at the First Street Foundation, we've been at this for about 4 years now. So we've been really working on smart ways to address our mission, which is to quantify and communicate climate risk and the fact that there is a changing climate to regular people. We want to figure out smart ways as a comms. We have a really good comms team here at the First Street Foundation to make this heavy, sophisticated science, something that's digestible and something that's accessible and something that's easy for regular people to understand. So we've been at this for about 4 years. Back in June of 2020, we actually launched our first report, which was really just focused on quantifying the risk with our model, which we built out. It was a high resolution, 3-meter horizontal resolution flood model that gave you the ability to look at properties specifically across different probabilities of storms. And we worked all the way from the 1 in 2 year event up to the 1 in 500 year event to give a lot of understanding of a more sort of holistic view of flood risk. And as we built that out, we found that if you use the public facing FEMA maps, there's actually 1.7 times more flood risk to properties across the U.S. than would be identified just using as a 1 in 100 special flood hazard area map from FEMA. So that was sort of our first report. We wanted to try to get to the point to where we were quantifying risk across the country. And then after we launched it, we put all the data up. We have a tool called floodfactor.com that we make available to for free. We make all of our data available to folks that want to look it up on their property. But a lot of people went there and they looked at it and they said, all right, so I have, moderate risk of flooding. And, what does that mean? It doesn't really mean anything to a lot of people. So we built out a second report focused on the economic damages of flooding. Again, leaning on federal government resources, publicly available data, but really taking those modeled flood depths across the different return periods in our model and turning them into average annualized loss indicators to let people understand yearly or when the storm hits, this is how much it's going to cost economically. And that really went from the point to where people didn't understand the term risk in the way that we were presenting it out, but everybody responded to, oh, in dollars and cents, now this makes sense to me, and it's attached to my property. So all of a sudden, the being able to quantify risk in a way that made sense to people today and moving into the future was something that really resounded with folks. And we sort of realized that pretty quickly. So we actually built out a third report, which is the one that we're talking about today, which is a report that moves beyond just the property level. Our first two reports were focused on individual property level analyses. We wanted to understand beyond just the property. If your home, for instance, is in a place that's protected or it's at a high elevation, you're not likely to flood. There's still risk if your community infrastructure is at risk, or if the road network floods, or if your child's school or your church floods. So we sort of built out this third report to give a more well-rounded sort of community-focused understanding of risk and sort of to point to the fact that people have risk even when their own individual properties don't have risk.
Wow, fascinating discussion with Dr. Jeremy Porter. And I think this is important because, as I mentioned in the intro, I think people sleep on flooding. What I mean by that is people get all up and alarmed, rightfully so, when there's a tornado warning or when there is a hurricane approaching the coast. But I think oftentimes flooding and heat are often sort of perceived as not as sort of worthy of the, frenzy, if you will, in terms of warning. And we know that flooding is both deadly and costly. I think with the recent flooding, for example, with Ida in parts of the Northeast, I think people have a sense of just how deadly it can be. One of the things I noticed about your study is that there a 30-year time frame was used for the report. To what degree, if any, did climate change play in the modeling of the data?
Yeah, the ability to quantify the change out into the future is one of our primary interests at the First Street Foundation. We do want to show that risk today is different than what you probably think it is, but that it's going to continue to change as the environment continues to change into the future. We did a lot of sort of user testing and sort of focus groups and things like that early on, where we found that if we start talking about 2100, people don't care, or they do care, but it's somebody else's problem, or it's so far out that it's just hard to make it tangible to that person. When we started focusing on the 30-year period, there were two things that happened. One was it was near term enough that people realized it was going to impact them in their lifetime and relatively close in terms of sort of the sort of temporal scale. But then they also oftentimes attach that to their homes and to their properties and sort of an impact on their assets. So they would say, well, if I have a 30-year mortgage and you tell me I live in a 1 in 100 year zone, that's only a 1% chance of flooding each year. I'll take that. But then if you tell them over 30 years, if you take that joint probability, it's actually a 26% chance that you're going to get hit by a 1 in 100 year event over this 30 year period. Then people are like, wow, there's a 1 in 4 chance that I could get hit by a fairly significant flood over the time of my mortgage or over the short term in the next 30 years. So it really was the result of sort of interacting with a lot of people, trying to make the information usable, and then trying to communicate it in a way that more accurately reflected the risk that individuals held.
Yeah, I've often heard my colleague, Dr. Brian Bledsoe, here at the University of Georgia, talk about once in a mortgage instead of a 100 year. And I that's really an interesting way, because I think this concept of 100 year flood just really is confusing to people, because they, you know, you, as you stated, so even that terminology, there's a 1% chance, but I think that people don't understand that you could have 3 100 year floods in 1 year from a probability standpoint. Mm-hmm. But I think they interpret it as meaning, oh, that only happens every 100 years. And so with climate change, we know that's changing itself. You mention and deal with infrastructure, and it's a very broad catch-all term that we're hearing quite a bit about today, particularly with infrastructure bills being considered, and devastation to infrastructure from extreme weather events and so forth. Tell us a bit more about how you think about infrastructure and how it's broken down in your study. I know you kind of alluded to it somewhat in your answer earlier.
Yeah, so we that's a really good point, because there are certainly components of infrastructure that we don't capture in our analysis. And a lot of what we do here at the First Street Foundation is where, you know, all of our research, all of our reports, all of our models, we publish the results. We put out technical documentation. We make all of the methods, even for our flood models, open and transparent through the peer review process in the academic journals. So all the information is publicly available, which makes us a little bit different from other risk indicators or other companies that are doing this type of modeling, in the sense that lots of times their models are proprietary, so they're not putting that information out into the world. We're as a nonprofit, we're in a kind of a unique spot that we're able to, but it also means that we're generally relying on publicly available data for our analyses also. So we're in doing the infrastructure analysis, we focused on critical infrastructure from primarily government resources, where we could find what we thought was exhaustive or near exhaustive accounting of what we would end up including in our critical infrastructure category. So for critical infrastructure, we include things like airports, fire stations, hospitals, police stations, ports, power stations. But then we also have things that are important to the community's sort of health and safety, things like hazardous waste sites and water outfall locations and wastewater treatment plants. We built on top of that and added a social infrastructure category, which includes government buildings, historic buildings, places of worship, and museums and schools. And then we added to that the from the Census Bureau, we took their road network, and we broke the road network across the country into 100 meter segments. And we treated every 100 meter segment as its own sort of point of interest, as a piece of infrastructure. So that's essentially how we've grouped infrastructure. We don't include things that oftentimes get sort of reported on, things like bridges. You know, bridges have had a lot of coverage in recent years as critical infrastructure. We don't include, for instance, stormwater management infrastructure that we don't have access to. So for a lot of cities, you know, the underlying stormwater management system or even wastewater management system isn't publicly available. So we're not able to include that in our analysis. But we essentially are capturing emergency services, sort of social community points of interest, and then the network through which those emergency services are carried to people.
Don't pay retail for your diamond engagement ring or gift. Come to cleanorigin.com. We're experts in ecologically friendly lab-grown diamonds. Mention code RADIO10 for 10% off. That's cleanorigin.com, online or one of our retail stores.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
And we are back on the Weather Geeks podcast. I'm Dr. Marshall Shepard from the University of Georgia, and I'm speaking with Dr. Jeremy Porter about flooding in America's infrastructure, something that is certainly on the minds of many people who actually live in flood zones or perhaps federal authorities or industry that have facilities in flood-prone areas and so forth. So this is a really critical discussion today. There's something that I find very interesting in your report. The report found that 23%, almost one in four of all road segments in the country, nearly 2 million miles of road are at risk of becoming impassable. Was that surprising to you?
That, as I mentioned earlier, almost all of our reporting to this point has been focused on residential properties. And we were almost positive when we walked into the analysis that residential properties were going to be the most at risk across the country, and that critical infrastructure, roads, commercial properties were all going to be built to a standard that protected them against the risks that some residential properties had. And what we found was the opposite. Residential properties were actually the lowest at risk in our analysis, 14% across the country, 23% of roads, as you mentioned, and 25% of our critical infrastructure group. And what really jumped out to me in that analysis was when you need the emergency services the most, the hospitals, the police stations, the fire stations, this is during a flood and during a disaster. And this is the group that's the most at risk in our analysis. And then the other thing when you talk about roads is that's how those emergency services are delivered. So not only is your critical infrastructure and your emergency services at such a high risk, but the ways in which we get those to people during an emergency are also going to be blocked, and they're also going to end up at risk, or they were at risk in our analysis. So, there's this sort of compounding factor here where in communities that have high flood risk, both their emergency services and their roads are likely to have more flood risk than the residential properties in that same community.
Were there other aspects of the study? I mean, I found that very surprising, but what surprised you as one of the scientists involved? What are some other things that, as you really started digging into the results, that really just jumped out at you as like, wow?
Yeah. One of the things that always surprises me in our report, and I think it's probably, would surprise a lot of folks, maybe not the scientists that are like the climate scientists that are into modeling this, but for somebody like myself that does implications research, I look at these results from our reports and I see, okay, Florida has a lot of risk. Louisiana has a lot of risk. Coastal South Carolina has a lot of risk. We knew that. We see the hurricanes on the news to get covered. We see them flooding a lot of these locations. What always surprises me is the rainfall and precipitation risk that occurs inland in places like West Virginia and Eastern Kentucky, and then the floods that happened in Tennessee earlier this year and all the way up into New England. And then if you start to project into the future with using the global climate models, you can start to see trends that are going to drive tropical storms further north moving into the future. So they're not necessarily, the science of course is mixed a little bit on this, but there's not necessarily going to be more of these tropical storms, but they tend to be, as you're projecting outwards, likely to move further north and moving at a slower pace. So they're dropping more precipitation, they're reaching places in the mid-Atlantic and into New England that they used to not hit with the same amount of power. And you're starting to see huge amounts of risk in some of these more inland places. I think we mentioned Ida, or you mentioned Ida earlier. Ida is a perfect example of that. I mean, it hit the coast. It was tied with Laura. It was one of the strongest storms to hit the Louisiana coast. So it was certainly a strong hurricane when it hit the coast. But then it worked its way up through the middle of the country as primarily a precipitation event. And we're in New York. Our offices are in in Brooklyn, and it was just devastating flooding in the New York City area. And it was really the product of, you know, sort of a strong tropical storm that sort of held together, moved slowly through the area, and just dumped a ton of precipitation in areas that maybe it hasn't in the past.
One of the things talking with Dr. Jeremy Porter, even with one of my own graduate students in the past, Dr. Benita Casey, who's a data scientist at NASA, is this idea of climate risk in the year 2040. And we found some of the same things, this inland risk, these urban risks, you know, the risks aren't just anchored to the coast with flooding and hurricanes. And so I strongly resonate with what you're saying. Now, given your background in sociology and urban geography and so forth as well, Jeremy, I was thinking about our good friend Josh Bexler. So shout out to Josh Bexler who books these. I saw his name flash across the screen. Jeremy, what do you see or find in terms of vulnerability, in terms of demographics? I know that there are certainly some communities, marginalized, perhaps poor communities, communities of color that may be predisposed. I know you were focused more on infrastructure, but given what you were just saying about Ida and some of the deaths that we saw in basement apartments and so forth, have your results been able to sort of inform that discussion?
Yeah, and we have a lot of researchers that we're working with in the First Street Research Lab across the country. We share our data regularly with academics to do a lot of this research, but some of the stuff that they're doing and that we're sort of working on, we find that, you know, flood risk is one of the, in a lot of ways, is an equalizer in a lot of ways. I mean, a lot of folks there are very wealthy communities along the coast that have flood risk. And then there are places that are more working class and more middle class, where you know, if their property was to be damaged, that's their primary asset, and it's sort of tied that most of their wealth is tied up in that property. The big difference is the way that people can respond to that. So if you're inland, and you're, especially if you're looking at places like West Virginia and Eastern Kentucky and those locations, you're talking about in the places where there's flood risk, and you're talking about a more working class type of community. And in those places, especially when you compound that with the fact that the FEMA special flood hazard area maps don't generally map heavy precipitation events very well, which is the type of flooding that occurs in these spaces, all of a sudden you have a lot of unknown risk in working class communities. So when in our research, we didn't necessarily find that there's more risk among working class communities, but what we tended to find was that there's more unknown risk lots of times, because the federally facing special flood hazard area maps don't capture the type of flooding that occurs outside of the coastal surge areas and the large river channels.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
And we are back on the Weather Geeks podcast. I'm Dr. Marshall Shepard, and I'm having a fascinating discussion, albeit a scary one, with Dr. Jeremy Porter. And again, I don't say scary in the sense of just this idea of climate change and floods being these big, bad risks. It's scary from the standpoint that we have an aging infrastructure. We have an infrastructure that's vulnerable to this generation of climate. And so this study is very important, and I appreciate Dr. Porter coming on Weather Geeks to talk about it. One of the questions that I you know, that may be on the minds of some of the listeners, now that we have such information down to a neighborhood level, how can we use this to better prepare for the future?
Yeah, it's, you know, we've been working on this for over a year now, which it actually was quite a coincidence with all of the discussions around infrastructure that are happening in DC right now to put out this report at the same time. But there are a lot of parallels in the sense that there is going to be at some point some amount of money probably that's available for infrastructure hardening and for adaptation. The biggest problem that we've run into in the last year and a half is that there's a lot of small communities that have reached out to us for our data because they want to do their own sort of resilience planning, but they don't have engineers on staff and they don't have floodplain managers on staff. So we, even when we give them the data, they're not really sure what to do with it. They're not really sure how to understand or even screen for risk. So from my perspective and being more of a population scientist and focused a lot on policy, is that the first step in sort of addressing these issues is that communities need a smart way to understand their own flood risk. They need to be able to screen their infrastructure, their residential properties, their just larger communities for the risk that exists so that they can start to understand what the risk is to their constituents, but also what's the next step? Once you have good data and you understand that there is this type of risk, what do you do next to protect against that? And that's really the gap that we were hoping to fill with this community report. We figured out early on there are a lot of places don't have the engineers or the staff. You know, we've also talked to Miami and New York City, and those places have all the resources they need for planning for these types of things. So we're not necessarily addressing those types of cities, but the counties and the communities and cities that are smaller that don't have those resources but want to understand their flood risk. We've made that available now in our community analysis so that people can take that first step. They can understand their own risk.
And I'm glad to hear you say that, because as someone that's been sort of in the weather climate world for a while, I do often feel we can have large city biases when we think about impacts on extreme events or from climate change. And we often forget that there are a lot of people that live in smaller cities and towns and even rural areas that are still exposed to some of these challenges. I grew up in a small town here in Georgia. I mean, it's metropolitan Atlanta now, but at the time it was just a small town that likely had flood issues, but you know, might have gotten lost. And so I'm really excited to hear that you say that, what you just said in that last answer. Is this something that, you know, I guess like the IPCC, you need to do periodically, every 4 years, every 10 years, like the census, to really keep track of what's going on? Or is this sort of a one-time deal?
Yeah, we're definitely, I mean, we got the first version of it out. We have hydrologists on staff that are working with the new CMIP-6 projections, and we're constantly updating our digital elevation models, looking for the best inputs into the model. So we'll continue to improve the model. We haven't figured out yet what the cadence will be on sort of report releases around flooding. I think it would make sense if any input data dramatically changes. So if we get new climate data that gets validated and looks like it's a vast improvement on past iterations of the data that we were using, then I think that would certainly necessitate a full run of the model, a full analysis, and sort of producing new reports. But our plan is to constantly be producing some type of report. So again, we did a property analysis, an economic analysis. We've done an analysis so far on community risks. Now we're going to build out other climate perils as part of our offerings too. So we're working on a fire model now with a group out in California. And what we're just going to continue to build out these climate models and make them publicly available. We're going to put all of the research in the peer review system in an open and transparent way. We're going to produce tools online that individuals can use. And our focus is really, and this may be a point I should have made earlier, our focus is really on marrying the science with the communications aspect. Because so often there's really, really good stuff that comes out of the science and the work that gets done around climate. But it lives in academic journals and in technical reports, and it doesn't make its way to individuals. So we really focus on distilling a lot of that information, relating it to implications, and then translating that to regular folks.
Yeah, I think that's so important because, again, now how many people read our academic papers and journals? Not too many. Where can people find more out about your model, your data, your report?
Yeah, all of our technical documentation and research reports are on our site at First Street Foundation, firststreet.com. But we also have the tool, floodfactor.com. And I think that that's probably the best tool for individuals to use. You can go on, you can look at property, neighborhood, county, state level risk indicators. You can go through and look at the actual outputs from our risk report, from our economic damages report, and from our community report. It's all there. It's all interactive. You can scroll around in the community and see which points of interest are at risk. So I would encourage folks. It is free. It's available. It's publicly available at floodfactor.com.
So where can people find you on social media? Are you on Twitter or anything that people can follow you?
I am on Twitter. I'm embarrassed to say that I'm not very active. I'm at J. Reed Porter, but I think the better place to follow us on social media would be on our First Street accounts. I think we have a really good comms team that's constantly putting out new content, and that would probably be the best place to follow us and what we're doing.
Fair enough. This has been so fascinating, and we have to end it there. But before we do, it's time for our Geek of the Week. We like to highlight a scientist superstar, a great geologist, or a weather weenie at the end of every podcast. This episode's Geek of the Week is Erin Sheffield. Erin is pursuing her master's in emergency management from Millersville University, and she loves to use her passion of meteorology and GIS mapping to help inform those of the impacts of natural disasters. Her goal is to better incorporate GIS into the disaster response framework in order to improve planning, response times, collaboration, and communication during the most challenging dynamic situations. Thank you for continuing the push for better disaster response, Erin. To follow along with Erin, check her out at the Geo Goddess. I love the Twitter handle, at the Geo Goddess. And thank you again for joining us on the Weather Geeks podcast. Really fascinating, and we'd love to have you back anytime.
Hey, I really appreciate it. It was fun to talk with you.
I'm Dr. Marshall Shepard from the University of Georgia. We'll talk to you next time on Weather Geeks.